Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 25th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead story from the front cover of this week's Triangle Business Journal is the Glaxo Gamble, also known as Trading Spaces, how the GSK-Novartis swap impacts the Triangle and the industry at large. This article is written by Jason DeBruin. This week, three big pharma companies dropped a major asset swap announcement on the world in the middle of the night. Piecing together the deal reveals another step towards consolidation in the pharmaceutical industry that executives say will benefit the companies and critics say will hamper research and development and ultimately hurt patients and drive up drug costs. In a transaction that could eclipse $25 billion, GlaxoSmithKline sold its oncology business unit to Novartis and bought the vaccine unit, except influenza, from Novartis. In addition, Novartis sold its animal health business to Eli Lilly. What may be a bigger concern is the fact that thousands of local jobs are woven into this deal, a scenario that would shuffle the local workforce, real estate footprint, and charitable dollars. While it's impossible to know exactly how the deal will affect each Triangle employee, the deal won't close until mid-2015. By the very nature of the business units on the table, certainly things become clear. Much of GSK's oncology and consumer health workforce calls Philadelphia home. Conversely, RTP focuses heavily on research and development, and their respiratory business unit, a key franchise, as GSK calls it, and an area where CEO Andrew Witty wants to double down. The future of Novartis RTP employees, on the other hand, is more in limbo. The 550 Novartis employees at the Holly Springs facility work on influenza vaccines, the only part of the vaccine business Novartis held back in the GSK deal. The Swiss drug giant said it will put that unit up for sale in a separate deal, although it did not talk about potential suitors. Investors generally approved of the deal, sending Glaxo stock up 4% and Novartis stock up 1%. Eli Lilly stock dropped about 1% on April 22nd, the day of the announcement. The swaps allow each company to unload assets outside of their focus areas in favor of assets of strength that will enable them to gain footholds in those markets. In 2007, GSK saw revenue from oncology decrease from 2% to a pie slice so small that by 2013 it was listing oncology under the segment Other Pharma on its financial reports. By contrast, vaccines pushed their way into the Glaxo portfolio, growing from 9% of sales in 2007 to 14% of sales in 2013. Naturally, with the addition of Novartis's rather sizable vaccine offerings, GSK will see that percentage increase as it will become the number one producer of vaccines when the deal closes in mid-2015. It also gives us a very rare, extraordinarily rare, opportunity to substantially strengthen our vaccine business and at the same time find a home for our nascent oncology business with a partner who has much bigger scale than we have in that particular field, said GSK's Witty in a conference call with reporters. In Research Triangle Park, which houses the North American headquarters of London-based GSK, workers might see more attention. After all, most of the oncology work for GSK happens in Philadelphia, whereas the Triangle division works in the respiratory segment, which has made up 27% of GSK's 2013 revenue. Indeed, nearly every respiratory product passes through GSK's manufacturing and packaging facility in Zebulon at one point in the process. While many analysts like Glaxo, Novartis, Lilly swap, some industry observers remain cautious of the consolidation landscape. Alan Castles, who has authored or co-authored books critical of the pharmaceutical industry, including Seeking Sickness, Selling Sickness, and Excessive Medical Spending, points out this deal serves to further decrease competition. Industry watchdogs have shown that spending on research and development decreases as pharmaceutical companies merge. As that R&D decreases, so does the influx of new or improved drugs. Although the deal between GSK and Novartis does not involve a merger, it certainly eliminates elements of competition. There is nothing like having a competitor snapping at your heels to really focus you and really motivate you to be the first to the market, Castles says. The merging activity has been good for the companies, but not so good in terms of new products. A recent article published in the academic journal Nature points out that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved an average of 31 drugs per year between 1990 and 1999, but only 24 per year between 2000 and 2009. An underlying factor contributing to the productivity observed in the 1990s was the large number of pharmaceutical companies at that time, writes research author John LaMattina, the former president of Pfizer Global Research and Development. Many of the drugs that were approved in 96, a year which saw 54 drugs approved, originated from companies that no longer exist. Consider that of the 42 members of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, PhRMA, the industry's primary association that existed in 1988, only 11 remained in 2011. David Ridley, an associate professor at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, who focuses on the pharmaceutical and healthcare industries, says companies often merge out of a position of weakness, and as such, they might have been even less productive individually, he says. The firms might look reasonably productive at the time, but they might be anticipating future weakness, Ridley adds. How do you account for that underlying weakness when counting R&D spending or FDA approvals? He further points out that efficiencies through a focused sales force are very real benefits to pharma companies. If one salesperson can offer a variety of similar products in the same portfolio, it benefits not only the company but the doctors and ultimately the patients, because they can potentially choose a more targeted therapeutic from among a variety of similar products from a single company. The blockbuster pharma deal announced April 22nd left a slightly different taste for Novartis than it did for GSK. While GSK divested itself of business units largely outside the RTP area to focus on those units in which RTP plays a major role, Switzerland-based Novartis sold off the very business unit in which its Holly Springs facility plays a role. To be sure, Novartis sold GSK its vaccine business, except influenza, and those with a keen eye on the RTP scene know that's exactly what the 550-person, 164,000-square-foot facility in Holly Springs focuses on. But Novartis also said it would seek to sell that unit as well, leaving a figurative question mark looming over the production plant housed under its vaccines and diagnostics division. It's an impressive facility by many measures. With help from a Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, known as BARDA, contract with the federal government, the total investment at the Holly Springs facility is estimated to run north of $1 billion. As of December 31st last year, Novartis had already spent $422 million on the project, net of grants reimbursed by the government. Specifically, scientists there work under a pre-pandemic preparedness contract specifically to provide late-stage development and manufacturing expertise and capabilities to support HHS-driven projects, including development of new biodefense agents and rapid manufacturing response in the event of a public health emergency. For example, the contract was used to develop a new strain for H7N9, a strain of avian influenza that emerged in China in early 2013. Novartis executives are remaining mum about plans for the Holly Springs location, saying only through a statement that Novartis has initiated a process to invite bids to sell the influenza business separately to maximize total value. Potential suitors would likely put the Holly Springs facilities in the positives category when weighing the pros and cons of buying Novartis's influenza program, although that does not necessarily mean a purchaser would keep employees or production here. A short side panel refers to GSK's research and development headcount. With 1,300 employees in the Navy Yard, 3,815 employees in the Research Triangle Park, 3,219 employees at Research and Development Pennsylvania location, 471 employees in Parsippany, New Jersey, and 375 employees in Pittsburgh. This week's column on commercial and residential real estate is covered by Amanda Hoyle, and she leads with an article entitled MetLife's on a Local Hiring Binge. MetLife is already ahead of its hiring projections for its new $110 million global technology and operations hub in Cary, and it is still receiving about 1,000 new resumes a week. That's according to Jeff Lang, who has been leading the Triangle operations for MetLife since last July, and Jim O'Donnell, who moved here from New York and officially took over as site leader for MetLife's GTO hub on January 1st. Amanda Hoyle visited with both executives on Thursday following a charity grant presentation at the Grambling Institute in Durham to get an update on the insurance giant's hiring process and details on how they are fitting in. Currently, about 400 of the 1,200 jobs MetLife promised to create at its new Cary campus have already been filled. O'Donnell says the goal is to have more than 700 employees hired in the Triangle by the end of 2014, but current projections could push the numbers beyond 1,000 people by then. Since late April 2013, Lang says they have received more than 52,000 resumes. "We are exceeding our plans here, which is a great problem to have," O'Donnell says. He's already concerned that they'll run out of space in their temporary office building in the Imperial Center Park in Durham before their new campus in Cary is finished in mid-2015. "I'm already in planning for that because we're already running out of space," Lang says. In response to reports that companies like MetLife, Fidelity Investments, and Red Hat are having trouble finding talent with the technology skills they need, O'Donnell says that there are always certain skill sets that will be hard to fill, particularly in big data and analytics. "Maybe you have to change the way you recruit those people or change the job description," he says, "but overall we've had incredible success recruiting here. The word is getting out there." This summer, MetLife will be launching two internship and training programs targeting local university students and graduates, MetLife University and MetLife Tech University. "We have, of course, have had internship programs before, but this is taking it to the next level," says O'Donnell. MetLife has also initiated a detailed 5-day training program for all new hires that go through MetLife's strategy and operations. "We don't just hire them and throw them in," Lang says. MetLife is currently hosting a new employee training class every 2 weeks. And what follows is MetLife by the numbers. 400. The number of people that MetLife employs in the Triangle areas as of April 2014. 1,200. The number of jobs that MetLife is slated to create by the end of 2015. 52,000. The number of resumes received so far for MetLife's Triangle jobs. Up next, Jason DeBrun. Mr. DeBrun covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. This week's column from Jason is entitled "TransEnterix Focuses on Market for Surgical Robots." Morrisville surgical robots developer TransEnterix took a step out of the shadows, setting its sights on FDA approval and a commercial launch of a new medical device its CEO says will expand the robot surgery market. TransEnterix moved off the OTC bulletin board and to the New York Stock Exchange on the New York Stock Exchange Market, which was renamed from New York Stock Exchange Amex, and it's intended for trading stocks of smaller companies. It trades under the symbol TRXC. The company was founded in 2007 and developed the Spider surgical robot. TransEnterix sold 3,500 of the single-use devices, but surgeons provided feedback on ways to make it better. Now TransEnterix is developing the SurgerBot system, which CEO Todd Pope says builds on the Spyder but brings improvements. Pope also touts that TransEnterix will charge $500,000 for the SurgerBot, well below the $1.2 million to $2 million at Intuitive Surgical charges for its widely known Da Vinci robot. Although Intuitive is the leader in surgical robots with $6 billion in sales in the past 3 years, the market is still wide open. After all, surgeries in this country ran up a bill of nearly $180 billion in 2010 alone. The SurgerBot will be used mostly for common surgeries like bariatric or gallbladder. That's why Pope says it won't really compete with the Da Vinci, which surgeons typically use for other kinds of surgery. While many pharmaceutical companies might contract with a sales force to market a new drug, Pope said it's more appropriate for surgical device companies to hire an in-house sales staff. That team is only two people strong at the moment, but Pope said TransEnterix would beef it up dramatically as commercial launch for the SurgerBot, expected in 2015, draws near. In April, TransEnterix had about 100 employees company-wide. A homegrown boy, Pope attended elementary and middle school in Raleigh and graduated from Millbrook High. He later graduated from UNC Chapel Hill and now lives in Chapel Hill. Following the money this week in Jason's column, $32 million. Raleigh specialty pharmaceutical company Dara Biosciences filed notice to sell additional shares with a proposed maximum of $32 million. Dara retained Ladenburg Thalmann and Company Incorporated as a placement agent, and the broker will now test the market and solicit offers to buy shares. Once Dara gets a better feel for what the market will bear, it will set more specific terms about offering price and date. Dara has some specialty drugs on the market, specifically Soltamox, to treat breast cancer, and is developing a new treatment targeted for cancer patients. Also in this column, he said it. Mr. Jeff Williams has said you don't generally see that a whole lot in the mid-market. What he's talking about is the Clinipace CEO, after the Digital Contract Research Organization reached a preferred provider agreement with Massachusetts drug developer Karapharm Therapeutics. Typically, large CROs will reach long-term agreements with pharma companies, but Clinipace, a mid-market player, reached a similar deal in that space. Also, it should be known that there is a Wake teacher's resignation at an alarming rate. More than 600 Wake County school teachers have resigned just since the first of the school year, something the Wake County Public School System called alarming. Resignations have risen sharply through the years, with more than twice the number of resignations this year as in 2010-11 school year, and a 41% increase from last year. In 2009 and 2010, there were 251 resignations, 301 the following year, in 2011 and 2012, 393, the year after that, 433, and in 2013-2014 school year, there were 612 teacher resignations from the Wake County school system. Moving on to Dawn Curry's column, Dawn covers small business, personalities, and triangle trends. Mr. Jeff Fisher has a customer rewards app to help market small businesses. He is the CEO of Durham Land and Development and Conservation firm called Unique Places and has invested in an app that will allow shoppers who are loyal to local businesses to earn rewards. The app was called Lolo, was developed by Fisher's friend Clark Harris, a Nashville tech entrepreneur who has been building tools to help small businesses grow their online presence. "I think it's going to be wildly successful," Fisher says while showing me how it works on the phone. Right now, the concept exists only as a mobile website, but in the next few weeks, it will be available through various cross-platform application stores. According to the founders, it has about 600 users and 23 active merchants. When customers spend money with a local merchant in the network, they get a 5% reward that can be used with any merchant in that network. Next up is the Nashville market. Harris says the biggest obstacle after funding is reaching local merchants. And while Nashville has a variety of neighborhoods, the Triangle is a different beast. The problem with the Triangle is it's more fragmented, Harris says. Durham and Raleigh and Chapel Hill each have their own vibe. We need enough anchor merchants to get the consumer excited. He says the app should ideally have a city manager for each market and in the Triangle, and that means having several people on the ground. Next up, Raleigh firm turns metal trash into cash. China pays big bucks for our metal trash, such as old computers and refrigerators. Raleigh Metal Recycling and sister company Greensboro Metal Recycling collect old metal for profit. They exported $9 million in scrap metal to China in 2013. A lot of people don't understand recycling metal, says CEO Greg Brown. It's energy efficient. According to Brown, making aluminum from melted down soda cans saves 94% of the energy it would take to mine the raw materials necessary for the production of aluminum. Likewise, if old copper is reused, it saves 86% of the energy it takes to produce copper from raw materials. With China being a global base of electronics manufacturing and exporting products such as Apple's iPad and Google's Android phones, we can say with certainty that portions of the copper and aluminum in Chinese products shipping to the U.S. are coming from recycling companies here in North Carolina and throughout the U.S., Brown says, who adds that China consumes about 50% of the world's copper. According to the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, recycling companies across the nation exported $9.5 billion of all scrap commodities to China in 2012. With the U.S. Department of Commerce stating the trade deficit with China hit a new high of over $318 billion in 2013, scrap metal and other scrap commodities are part of the solution to a balanced trade economy. Meanwhile, 75% of Brown's company's scrap metal doesn't travel farther than 300 miles from home. The good stuff tends to stay pretty local. Some of it stays in North Carolina, South Carolina, or Virginia. And there are very good markets here for the high-end steel and high-end copper, says Brown. Currently, there's a spotlight on bigger wind turbines that could propel North Carolina's energy section. Taller wind turbines and larger blades could lead the Southeast and North Carolina to expand its renewable wind energy sector. A new report from the U.S. Department of Energy shows that manufacturing larger wind turbines would address transportation and logistics challenges and may accelerate the development of new markets in low and moderate wind speed regions in the United States. According to Raleigh-based Brian O'Hara, president of the Southeastern Coalition Coastal Wind Coalition, North Carolina has a low to moderate wind speed on the land, and the further you are from the ground, the faster the wind is blowing. As you go up, the wind speed increases at a faster rate here than in other places, O'Hara says. It's places like the Southeast that are most impacted by improvements in technological advances. Current wind turbine diameters or blade lengths are 80 meters, 130 meters, and the new wind turbine blades are expected to be at or above 180 meters in length. Next up, Fibermania. This is Lauren Onisorge's column, and it's entitled Untangling the Triangle's Fiber Options. City of Raleigh became the first North Carolina metro to approve AT&T's plan to bring its Gigapower fiber-based internet service here. Gail Roper, Raleigh's chief information officer, says the timing is still up in the air, but the hope is to get the plan rolling before the year's end. Lauren asked if approval would impact the city's plan to entice Google and its Google Fiber service. It's a separate initiative, she says. Both will bring high-speed fiber to the region, which we know we need. One does not impact the other. And Time Warner Cable and other bidders in the North Carolina Next Generation Network, the initiative that requested the bid AT&T introduced in the first place, still have a shot, she says. It's an open market. We're excited about the opportunities. Lauren decided to untangle the options so that you, the listener, can get a better understanding of our fiber players. Google. Google Fiber is Google's high-speed fiber network, allowing users to access the web at speeds up to 100 times faster than basic broadband in Kansas City, where Google has already proven to be a driver of entrepreneurship. The catch. Google Fiber isn't a done deal, and if implemented, it only hits certain triangle cities and towns: Carrboro, Cary, Chapel Hill, Durham, Garner, Morrisville, and Raleigh. Each of the cities has to follow a checklist and submit paperwork by the 1st of June, and a decision isn't expected until the end of the year. An analyst I spoke to said it's likely they'll cherry-pick among the regions under consideration, which include Atlanta and Charlotte. And it may cost more than you're paying. Internet-only plans start at $70 in Kansas City. RST Fiber. The Shelby-based company, led by CEO Dan Limerick, was the first to come out with a definite yes regarding its plans to bring fiber internet to Raleigh. Having leased fiber lines from Research Triangle Park-based profit MCNC, in March, Limerick said high-speed fiber-based internet would be in Raleigh in 60 to 90 days, with high-speed television as a possible upgrade. The catch. RST isn't necessarily connected to your house by fiber. It plans to install specific access points on buildings and towers throughout the coverage area. Those access points will have up to a 2-mile range, offering Wi-Fi up to 1 gigabit. You'd sign on with your device and type in your credit card information, similarly to staying at a hotel. RST Fiber does say it will offer fiber to the premises connections, but for an additional fee, and residential service plans start at $99 a month. It remains unclear exactly how far the service will extend, although RST does have access to fiber lines across the state. Limerick's plan to start the service in Wake Forest, not Raleigh, to work out the kinks before taking it to the larger city. Limerick and team were in Wake Forest beta testing in April. AT&T wants to bring the same gigapower service to the Triangle that it debuted in Austin, Texas. While there will be a retail product for current and new U-verse subscribers, the plan also includes options for low-income users, as well as public Wi-Fi hotspots and connections to community centers and libraries. Already in the Triangle, AT&T has the home court advantage, and AT&T has invested $225 million in Raleigh alone over the past few years. They also expanded their plan, announcing more than 100 cities for service, including Charlotte and Greensboro. The catch. Like Google Fiber, AT&T Gigapower isn't yet mainstream. So far, the service is only offered in Austin, and there's a cost increase from your current U-verse bill, as plans in Austin start at $70. AT&T also needs approvals from other involved municipalities to really be a Triangle player. While Raleigh has approved the plan, Apex, Carrboro, Cary, Chapel Hill, Durham, Garner, and Morrisville have yet to give their stamps of approval. Other bidders. AT&T was one of 8 bids accepted by the North Carolina Next Generation Network, the university-driven initiative aimed at bringing fiber internet to North Carolina. And officials tell Lauren Onisores that other players, including Time Warner, are still in the mix. And on the move, Fredoso says it's a good time to go. Joe Fredoso, the longtime CEO of MCNC, tendered his resignation April 22nd. "I don't have another job," he tells Triangle Business Journal. "I didn't think it was right for me to look while I had the role." He says there are no hard feelings and that he wants to be involved in something that's innovative and new. "It's a good time to go," he says. "The organization is healthy financially." Also, this column from Lauren Onisorge, and as called, they said it, Yongqing Yang is quoted as saying, "We have some trouble here. Each year this group gets bigger and bigger. Should we ask the Carolina Hurricanes to lend us the PNC Arena next year?" The Lenovo CEO was speaking before 3,000 employees on April 15th at the firm's annual sales meeting in Raleigh. Also being quoted was Jerry Smith, head of Americas and Enterprise at Lenovo, speaking at the sales kickoff. "This is a market that's growing, and every time we get more connected, we're going to add more and more servers to our portfolio." And IBM by the numbers, the hardware declines mean an eighth consecutive quarter of weak revenue for computer services firm IBM. Hardware saw a 23% drop, though some software and business analytics were up 2% and 5% respectively. Cloud revenue was up more than 50%. $22.5 billion was the first quarter revenue, down 4%. $138 billion, services backlog up 1% adjusting for currency, and $2.3 billion, first quarter annual run rate for cloud delivered as a service. Next up, Ready, Set, Startup, the lucky entrepreneur behind the superfood shake. The driver was texting and driving, and I'm just lucky I made it. They didn't think I was going to make it because I had three separate bleeds in my brain. Scott Canoak talking about being struck by a truck during a bike ride. Scott Canoak is using Indiegogo to fund development of a superfood shake. He's a lucky guy, and he hopes that luck extends into the startup space. In 2001, the then Wall Street financial analyst was 20 minutes late. That's how he avoided being in the World Trade Center when the first plane hit. 4 years later, he left an appointment in London where he was one block away from when the subway bomb struck. But the closest call came 6 years ago on Market Street in Wilmington, where he moved for the lifestyle. On the 38th mile of a 40-mile bike ride, he was struck by a box truck. The side mirror forced off his helmet, and he went flying. The driver was texting and driving, he said, adding that he can't remember the next 11 days. I'm just lucky I made it. They didn't think I was going to make it because I had three separate bleeds in my brain. Rehab took 15 hours a week. All of this came with two kids and a pregnant wife at home. And along with every virus my kids brought home, he finally caught the one that would change his life. The entrepreneurship bug. Canuck developed what he calls an extreme superfood, a proprietary cocktail of organic vitamins, proteins, freeze-dried superfoods, and earth-based compounds called fulvic minerals, along with other things like probiotics. He gets the ingredients from suppliers in California and India. Since developing the nutritional shake, he claims he hasn't gotten sick. And since, really, it's just food, there's no need for FDA testing. The products come in tubs and packets packed priced at $44.99 for 15 servings. Canuck will soon post $80,000 Indiegogo campaign for the company called UB Super. A supplement from his accident as well as his life savings has supplemented, the settlement from his accident as well as his life savings have supplemented the company for the past 2 years, but Canuck wants to mass produce. And now it's time for a better world. News from the nonprofit world, written by Todd Cohen. Nonprofits team up to solve problems. 25 years ago, as part of a church group building a house for Habitat for Humanity of Wake County, Tom Gibson spent several weekends painting the house. He estimates his contribution was worth $25. "I'm not much of a painter," says Gibson, CEO of Thomas Gibson Homes, a Raleigh custom builder. In 2006, modeled on an effort a few years earlier by Gibson's company to build houses for Wake Habitat, home builders throughout the U.S., along with subcontractors and suppliers, built 459 homes worth $25 million for local Habitat affiliates. "By leveraging my acquaintances and friends, we were able to get a great deal," Gibson said at What Matters, an event at the Raleigh Convention Center on April 2nd, sponsored by Triangle Community Foundation, which focused on innovation and collaboration. Keynote speaker Leslie Crutchfield and more than 500 business leaders, government officials, and nonprofit representatives attending the event that groups working together can have a greater collective impact on complex problems than donors or nonprofits can have working on their own. "Great nonprofits build movements, not just organizations," said Crutchfield, a consultant who has co-authored books on catalytic donors and high-impact nonprofits. "Great nonprofits find points of leverage around them so they can amplify their impact. And it's all about how they work collaboratively," she said. She also said that in addition to delivering services, many great nonprofits also move into advocacy work because they find that's the only way they can make an impact. Durham-based Self-Help, for example, was created to make fair loans to low-income borrowers to help poor people bootstrap themselves out of poverty, Crutchfield said. But recognizing that many of its clients already were burdened with debt from predatory lenders, she said SelfHelp created the Center for Responsible Lending, which has built state and local coalitions and pushed for laws protecting consumers. Effective nonprofits also build networks to make greater impact than they could make by themselves. The CEO of the Heritage Foundation has taken the highly unusual step of sharing its donor list with like-minded think tanks, Crutchfield said, because it would help advance their common goal of free markets. Four nonprofits received awards from Triangle Community Foundation for innovation, collaboration, and advocacy. Recipients of the $5,000 awards were Kids Notes, a Durham nonprofit that uses orchestral training to improve the lives of kids and families. Wake Interfaith Hospitality Network, a Raleigh group that provides services to homeless families. North Carolina Conservation Network, a Raleigh nonprofit that supports environmental advocates. And Augustine Literacy Project, a Chapel Hill nonprofit that trains and supports volunteer tutors. Nonprofits have moved from isolated impact to collective performance, Crutchfield said. It means lifting up from worrying about the day-to-day at your organization while also driving towards larger goals, keeping in mind how you work with those around you. You should note that the author provides communication support for the Triangle Community Foundation. This week's executive voice is Catherine Peel. Catherine Peel is an architect and executive vice president of the practice at the Raleigh office of design firm LS3P. Catherine Peel came to the design field after studying music in college. When a detour in her late 20s sent her instead on a path that would elevate her into one of the most prominent design field roles in the state. She's only the second woman to chair the State Building Commission in North Carolina, and after serving several years managing the Raleigh office for the LS3P design firm, she was in 2010 invited to become one of the five directors on the firm's board. Peel was recently promoted again to position of Executive Vice President of Practice, a role in which she leads the marketing and professional services for the firm's six offices in the Carolinas. She's also a member of the AIA College of Fellows. Under her watch, LS3P has grown to become the third largest architect firm in North Carolina, with 24 people in the Raleigh office alone. She was also part of the teams that helped design such award-winning projects as the Centennial Campus Middle School and Friday Institute buildings at NC State University's Centennial Campus, and the renovation of the North Carolina Court of Appeals building downtown. Triangle Business Journal real estate reporter Amanda Hoyle caught up with Peel to find out more about this design leader. TBJ, you graduated from NC State University's College of Design. Did you grow up in North Carolina? Ms. Peel, my dad was a Marine officer, so our family moved all over the country as I was growing up. We moved to North Carolina when I was in my teens to be near my mother's family. TBJ, how and why did you choose a career in architecture? Ms. Peel, my father was always renovating whatever house we were living in. I was always fascinated with the process of building. In fact, the kids in our family were my dad's work crew, much to my mother's chagrin. I can still swing a hammer. However, I didn't find my way into the field of architecture until my late 20s. I started out my college career as a music major. TBJ, speaking of, have there been any missed opportunities in your life? Ms. Peel, I have always wondered where my life would have taken me if I had pursued my musical interest, voice, piano, and guitar. I wish I could find more time to get back into playing, maybe someday when life isn't so busy, but I have no regrets on the path that I chose. I have an incredible, rich, and rewarding life. TBJ, you were last year selected to serve as the chair of the State Building Commission. Are you the first woman to hold this role? Ms. Peel, actually, I believe I'm the second woman to hold this position. It's exciting to see women moving into leadership positions in the design and construction industry. When I first started my career, 26 years ago, there were very few women leading firms or holding top positions on boards or committees. TBJ, you also graduated as valedictorian of your graduating class. Rose, through the ranks to become COO of Boney Architects and helped orchestrate its merger in 2005 with LS3P. Have you always been an overachiever? Ms. Peel, it actually took me a lot of years to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. But once I discovered architecture, my passion for the field has fueled whatever successes I've been able to achieve. I've been truly blessed to have a supportive family, professional partners, and teammates. They make me look good. TBJ, do you have a mentor, and what lessons did they teach you? Ms. Peel, I've had several mentors in my professional career. Paul Boney, principal with LS3P, has been a strong mentor over the years, as well as Tom Penny, our CEO. The biggest lesson I've learned is to not let the ups and downs of this business get to you. And this too shall pass is a great thing to remember. TBJ, how has your job and career changed in the past 5 years? Ms. Peel, after serving as the Raleigh office managing principal for many years, I was recently promoted to executive vice president for practice. I headed up marketing and professional services for our 6 offices in the Carolinas. It's been a big transition, but I really enjoy having the opportunity to work across the entire firm to hopefully improve our market penetration and quality of service. TBJ, what is your favorite building, design-wise, in the world? Ms. Peel, Thorn Crown Chapel, designed by Faye Jones. TBJ, one thing you can't do without each day. Ms. Peel, bedtime snuggling with my girls, followed by a close second, coffee. TBJ, your favorite hobby? Ms. Peel, I recently rediscovered painting. Now I just have to find the time to do it. TBJ, what book are you reading right now? Ms. Peel, currently I'm reading Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, and The Book Thief. This week's family business column is by Mr. James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. This week's column is called Done Right, Succession Planning Offers Security and Continuity. Among people who think about such things, there is often a temptation to weep and moan about what goes wrong in planning for management and ownership succession in family-owned business and other closely held businesses. I do some of that myself. But then I stop to consider all the things that go right in succession planning, the decisions and initiatives that hands across that result in strong companies getting stronger and good families getting better. Here are a few of those things going right that I've seen lately. Careful thought and analysis, in some cases for the first time, about what makes the business run is one of the right things. Many business owners, especially family business owners and executives, are so involved in the daily grind that they don't take the time to think about the business in depth. Meeting the payroll and making a profit are important, of course, but looking carefully at what works and what doesn't work and why is also important, and succession planning demands such a look. Along with sorting through the company's current working parts, succession planning also provides an opportunity to review the company's history of challenges and accomplishments as a foundation for building the future. How did we come within a hair of defaulting on that big loan, and how did we dodge the bullet? Who introduced Dad to the man who became our most loyal customer? Why did we decide to add commercial maintenance to our landscape design and installation business? Historical review of the twists and turns that the business has taken over time can help in laying out a clear pathway for the future. Succession planning is an excellent platform for that review. Seeking out and using a variety of informed perspectives on the business's future often involves family members and other key persons in family and business strategic planning. The number of insights and good ideas that never reach the tabletop because nobody asked for them can be astounding. Family members and others inside and outside the business have a range of experiences. They read, they think, and all of that can contribute a heap of valuable information to shaping a major business transition, such as a management and ownership succession. But someone has to ask for it. The prospect of a significant change in a company's management, especially when the change might involve experienced people handing over leadership responsibility to somewhat less experienced people, can give stakeholders a touch of heartburn. Announcing that thorough, systematic succession planning is underway helps to reassure the family and other key people inside and outside the business of the stability and continuity of the company. It reconfirms everyone's faith in the company and in the wisdom of those who lead it today and those who will lead it in the future. Launching succession planning pushes the successor generation to think through its commitment to and preferred places in the company's future. Preparing for continuing family ownership and management with a new leadership team requires something much more substantial than, "Oh, I don't know, maybe I'll go to work for my dad's company." A better internal monologue sounds like this: "What can I bring to the family business? And what will it bring to me? What are my real reasons for making this business my life's work? What am I willing to do to be the best president the business could have?" It's true that some successful successors just stumble into the role, but that's not the way to bet. Planning for a succession transition often releases genuine creativity in conceptualizing management and ownership continuity through multiple generations of the company's future. It's not good to set up an ironclad protocol that locks the great-grandchildren into jobs they might not want in a company that might not be there in 50 years. But the process of passing the responsibility for maintaining business success to the rising generation can raise some pleasant visions of the family's long-term future. Also, the succession planning program can stir a renewal of application by the family and others and beneficiaries of the financial security and personal legacy provided by the business. Successful succession means going forward into the future, not just getting it through the year. The confidence that it can inspire is one more thing that goes right about succession planning. Sometimes unexpected partners take to the course. When you go to a media day event, you expect to see a bunch of journalists with their notebooks, microphones, and video cameras huddling and mingling with the officials, trying to squeeze out that last-minute exclusive nugget that no other media outlets were able to recover. But when you see country singer Scotty McCreery in that group, it's normal to let out a collective, "Huh?" Triangle Business Journal attended the April 21st U.S. Open Media Day event in Pinehurst among a throng of journalists, some coming all the way from Japan, Korea, and China. McCreery was not on their scope, but for Triangle Business Journal, it was important to get to the bottom of the situation. It turns out McCreery was playing golf with Carolina Hurricanes general manager Jim Rutherford and Canes player Jay Harrison in the morning, courtesy of the Pinehurst Resort folks, and of course the U.S. Golf Association. They were aware of it. From the video posted on the club's site, it looks like McCreery is an avid golfer, and he will likely return to the course to play what he calls the Valentine Cup. Other Triangle business TBJ spotted were anchor Gerald Owens of WRAL, sportcaster Mark Armstrong of WTVD, meteorologist Wes Hohenstein of WNCN, and local sports radio personality Adam Gold. Chatting with ESPN veteran Chris Bergman brought some laughs as well. From software exec to Iron Man. By day, B.J. Shakunowski heads up sales at the Cary-based software division of LexisNexis, meaning he's responsible for bringing our solutions to market and also ensuring they are implemented and used successfully by customers. But on weekends, the suit is traded for running gear as Shakunowski's not-so-secret alter ego is Iron Man. Shakunowski has competed in 5 Iron Man competitions, finishing 3 of those. He ran in the 2014 Boston Marathon, and he'll participate in the second annual Ironman event in Raleigh on June 1st. He says the lessons he's learned apply to business. "Your natural instinct is, 'I can't do it, that's too hard.' But no, you can. Other people do it. It's not as bad as you think." Also, Highwoods brings a Texan on board. Change has never come quickly to the board of directors at Highwoods Properties. 6 of its 8 board members have been directors for 10 years or longer. But a new member will be joining in May, if approved by shareholder vote, following the retirement of Ohio real estate developer Thomas Adler. Hadler has been serving on the Highwoods board, along with board chair O. Temple Sloan Jr., since the company's initial public offering in 1994. Nominated to take Adler's place is Chuck Anderson, 53 years old, who is co-founder of Bandera Ventures of Dallas, Texas, which is one market where Highwoods owns no properties. Anderson is also a former long-term senior executive director at Trammell Crow Company. Durham Donuts earn a national buzz. Durham's Monut Donuts co-founder Lindsay Moriarty says she is flattered by all the attention that the bakery has been getting from regional and national press. It most recently ranked among the 21 best donut shops in America by the website Thrillist. But one of her priorities with the shop has been to show that restaurants can still be profitable and successful while still paying its employees a living wage and benefits. Monut currently employs 13 people, plus Moriarty and her husband, Rob Gillespie, and all get seasonal bonuses, paid time off, and health insurance. We both gave up advanced degrees in our academic lives on a whim, and seeing it all come together has been magical, she says. This week's tweets of the week are as follows. I find it quite amazing that there are no direct buses between downtown Durham and downtown Raleigh. Why is that? From F. Scott Moody. Next up. Visitors spend $2.1 million per day in Durham, North Carolina. That's more than $1,000 per minute. And that tweet comes from Shelley Green. This week's column of Editor's Notebook is from Sugerta Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. His title for this week's column is Seidel's Claims Far From Finding a Smoking Gun. As I was reading the story about how Edward Seidel, the pension forensic investigator hired by the State Employees Association of North Carolina to perform an unofficial review of North Carolina's $87 billion pension fund, I was left wondering exactly what did Seidel find that should make the hundreds of thousands of retired state employees nervous. After all, they rely on Treasurer Janet Cowell's expertise for a financially solid pension fund that can pay the retirees and grow the balance. It reminded me of a line from the great movie A Few Good Men, starring Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise. A scene in that movie showed military lawyer Cruise grilling U.S. Marine Colonel Nickerson to get answers about a death that happened under Nicholson's watch at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. At one point, Nicholson said, "Phone calls and footlockers. Please tell me that you have something here, Lieutenant. These two Marines are on trial for their lives. Please tell me their lawyers haven't pinned their hopes to a phone bill." Putting it in context, Nicholson was trying to say that Cruz, the prosecutor, was swimming in minuscule evidence and there was no smoking gun in the line of questioning. Now back to Seidel and Cowell. Seidel accuses Cowell of secretly executing $30 billion in deals with Wall Street. Of course, Cowell's office disagrees and points to the agency's annual report that lists all of the department's investment holdings. Mind you, this accusation is coming just months after global investment research firm Morningstar anointed North Carolina pension fund to be the third strongest in the nation. While the treasurer's annual report does list most of the holdings, one thing is missing from these reports, and I believe that's where Seidel may have something. The annual report does not list all the management and placement agent fees that the agency shells out to fund managers, investment groups, and the Wall Street houses. For years, we have been asking for a detailed line-item listing of how much these outside managers are paid, but we get incomplete information, if any. As I have mentioned in this column before, I hope Cowell provides everyone with that info on a quarterly basis so we can see who is getting paid from North Carolina coffers. But for Seidel to argue that $30 billion cannot be located and therefore Cowell broke the law because of non-disclosures is simply a procedural point. Refer to that Nicholson quote about phone bills, please. Transparency offers clarity. This Seidel State Employees of North Carolina investigation to some extent may have been Cowell's office has not been as transparent as they could be. If for nothing else, perhaps Seidel's overstretch assumption may actually make at least one part of our state government more open and efficient. This week's guest column is Mr. Andrew Broad. Mr. Broad is a senior research fellow at UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. His column is entitled, Cutting Jobless Benefits Didn't Work. When North Carolina implemented sharp cuts in the size and duration of unemployment benefits last July, opinion was divided on what the effect would be. Many claimed the cuts would have what economists call an employment effect, leading people to take jobs they wouldn't take while receiving benefits. The hoped-for result would be faster rising employment. Others argued that cuts would not only hurt those depending on benefits, but lead to a participation effect, in which unemployed people become discouraged and leave the labor force. Both effects act to reduce the unemployment rate. And an employment effect does it directly by increasing the number of people with jobs. The participation effect does it indirectly because people not in the labor force are not counted as unemployed. Clearly, a strong employment effect would be good news for the state's labor market, while a participation effect would not be. Sure enough, since mid-2013, the state's unemployment rate has fallen 2 full percentage points to 6.3% in March. What's behind that? When last I wrote about this, I noted weak support for both the employment and participation effects. I said we'd have to wait for more data before getting a clearer sense of which effect had won. Now that data is here. Clearly, cutting unemployment benefits did not create jobs. Economic theory holds that cuts like that can increase labor supply by making some unemployed workers more eager to find work. But the weak job market isn't the result of insufficient labor supply, it's due to insufficient labor demand. The reason employers aren't doing much hiring isn't a lack of qualified people, though that may be the explanation for some occupations. Hiring is weak because consumer demand is still weak. On a per capita basis, taxable retail sales in North Carolina are still lower than before the Great Recession, despite the broadening of the tax base. Economic theory predicted that cutting unemployment benefits would have no effect on job creation and an economy with slack labor demand. Now the data have confirmed this. Want some irony? Reinstating the former level of unemployment benefits would create jobs by increasing consumer spending. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.